So I hope you were happy to be here. There's a few going, so I think they're happy to go. But while you were here, I hope you were happy to be here, so that's good. Because it's a very useful, I find it a very, very useful way to develop a feeling of contentment. I know Ajahn Brahm used to have this good enough was a way to develop contentment. But for me, good enough always suggested second best. I don't know whether you have that idea of good enough, but that's what it always suggests to me. So I like happy to be here much better, I think much better. And we can develop these positive emotions, as I say, to assist the meditation. So just while we are, as it were, interesting the mind in the object of meditation, be it the breath, the feet, if we're walking meditation, whatever subject we're using. Because if it becomes very attractive, if it becomes a pleasant feeling, we will stay with it. We won't want to move away from it. And of course, after some time of maintaining the attention on one object, what will naturally happen is joy and happiness comes up in the mind by itself. Then we don't need any assistance. It will do it by itself. It's automatic. So I hope some people were able to arouse this feeling. If you weren't, no matter. It's no matter. It's interesting. Because with meditation, I always say you can't do it wrong. You can't do it wrong. You can, whatever experience you have, that can be information. That can be data for learning from, either how to develop the meditation in different ways, or learning about our minds. And this is a very important part of Buddhism. But this evening I was going to talk not about happy to be here, though I hope it will be part of that experience. I was going to talk about what sort of world we want to live in, which is very topical, I think, for all of us. You know, it always is very relevant what sort of world we want to live in. And one of the teachings that I'm going to take this, the direction I'm taking this from, is a very traditional teaching in Buddhism that many, many people will know of. It's actually often called Dana, Sila and Bhavana. Dana, Sila and Bhavana. And this means giving, and it means ethical behaviour, and it means mental development. In traditional Buddhist countries, you hear this over and over again, actually. Dana, Sila and Bhavana. And why do they mention this all the time is because the Buddha mentioned them, these three things, giving, ethical behaviour and mental development, as bases, as sources for developing good karma. Good karma. So they're very important in that context. They're very active and I quite like them. So when I've been in Melbourne recently, I've taught a retreat based on Dana, Sila and Bhavana. And this evening I thought focus more on the Sila aspect, the ethical behaviour aspect. Because this is very much, isn't it, about the sort of world we want to live in. And I'll develop that in as we go along. And it's quite, what I like too, and I've been doing this in Melbourne, is to do complete teachings. So I've done a series of talks on the Noble Eightfold Path in Melbourne. And this is a complete teaching in a sense too, when we have these three qualities, Dana, Sila and Bhavana. And I call practices, 24/7 practices, because we can develop them 24/7. And they are a way of developing an important principle in Buddhism, which is to avoid or overcome negative mind states and to bring up and develop and maintain positive mind states. And this is one of the essence of the Buddha's teaching. And it's one of the very famous teachings of the Buddha is, and in traditional Buddhists know this very much, it's called in the Pali, it's called Sabba Pabasa Akaranam Kusalasa Upasampada Sanchita Pariyodapanam Etang Buddhana Sasanam. And this is not to do any bad, to cultivate the good, and to purify our minds. This is a teaching of all the Buddhas, not just the Buddha Gautama, the last Buddha. So, and this is the essence of our spiritual life, if we feel that we are reducing the negativity in our life, if we feel we're developing the positive in our life, this is a spiritual practice. This is going in the right direction. Unfortunately, I think many times I've seen, and in not only other people, I see it in myself sometimes too, some people are developing very negative states of mind, really getting into it, you know, really developing anger. So it becomes a rage, becomes a source of energy, but it's a very destructive source of energy driven by a sense of self. And it's what many people are developing. But as I say, with the Buddha's teaching, we can develop whatever we wish. We can develop the wholesome, we can develop the unwholesome. But the Buddha is saying, if you want to be happy, develop the wholesome, develop the positive, and reduce and abandon the negative. And this is a recipe for happiness. And of course, as I said, you know, the aspects I was going to focus on this evening, the aspect is going to be on ethical behavior. But first of all, just to recap the other qualities of giving. Giving is a very, very important thing that in Buddhism, in the Buddha's teaching. And it's not just giving to monks and nuns. In traditional Buddhist countries, of course, this is what people will do. But I say to, Sri Lankan people who come to the monastery or to the meditation centre, the Buddhist centre that I'm staying in Melbourne, that's not enough. If you only go to a monastery once a year to offer food, that's not enough, you know, to make a giving an important factor in your life. And of course, giving, as I say, is a 24/7 practice. We're all giving in different ways, but often we don't think of it as giving. You know, parents are giving to children, they're looking after their children. We're giving to the people we work with and our friends and other people that we meet, even strangers we give to. But often we don't think of it as giving. That's the problem, actually. Or we think, well, I'm a father, I'm a mother, I have to do this. And we don't get the joy and the happiness out of giving. And this is the important aspect of developing giving, because then we can use, and I use this quite often myself with meditation, giving, the sense of giving to the meditation, giving to the breath. And can be a very powerful way of bringing joy and happiness to the meditation. So giving is a very useful thing to develop, to fuel the meditation. And I like, I recently saw a video of one teacher, and I thought it was a really good point. He said, if we want to get, we may not get, but if we want to give, who can stop us? That's very true. You know, if you want to get, maybe we won't get. But if you want to give, this feeling of openness, of giving wholeheartedly, of course, this is an important point, isn't it, with giving? We give wholeheartedly and with a lot of joy and happiness. That way it becomes a strong, it develops strong karma and can become a very powerful influence in our life, in fact, in our spiritual practice. And of course, in traditional Buddhism, they think of giving material things very often. They'll give things for the monastery, robes and bowls and food, of course, and medicine and shelters, you know, huts for the monks or the nuns. And that's very traditional. But of course, there's so much more we give. We give attention, we give kindness, we give humour, we give advice. Whatever we can give. And of course, what's the most important thing these days you can give? What's the almost the, we say, rarest thing these days? Any suggestions? Time, yes. Time is the thing. Even time for one's children. I've heard many parents, you know, they just don't have that much time, you know. So time is something that we can give to people, give to ourselves too, you know, not this. Otherwise, we're always driven by the schedule. Time pressures, as we say, time pressure. And I think of this immaterial or non-material sort of giving. I think Ajahn Brahm is a very good example of that. He gives a lot. He has a lot of humour and gives a lot of advice. And just an example, actually, is very important. And so I think very, very important just to realise that we are giving, but to bring the mind state to it. Yes, this is giving. And transform it from something that we don't pay much attention to, or maybe we overlook, or we think it's our duty, our responsibility, it's nothing much, everybody has to do this. Turn it into something that's for our spiritual practice. And as I say, we can do this 24/7 and giving. And that way, you know, we are cultivating the spiritual path, and we're cultivating happiness and joy and a positive state of mind, which can bring to the meditation and we can bring to our lives. Because this is very much meditation, as I say, often say to people, is a reconditioning of the mind so that we're developing these positive, wholesome qualities, and we bring it into our lives and develop it in our lives. And the second factor of this three qualities, ethical behaviour, I'll go into in more detail in a minute, but that is developing a happiness from the fact that we are not harming ourselves, we're not harming others. And the Buddha often talked about the happiness of blamelessness, not being blamed. And this is, ethical behaviour is something that's very important because it's a 24/7 practice. We have ethical situations come up day and night, at times we least expect it, at work, at home, anywhere they can come up. So this is something that's very important to our lives. And of course, the last one, mental cultivation, is the one that people are usually interested in when they're interested in meditation. Because mental cultivation, the main one, mental development or mental cultivation, the main one is meditation. But there are many other aspects to that, to developing wholesome states of mind and abandoning negative states of mind. But as I say, this too is a 24/7 practice because we live with our minds day and night. And we can either cultivate negative states of mind, as I mentioned before, or positive states of mind. Oftentimes, and this is something I've seen very much, people tend to think whatever mind state they're experiencing at that time, well, what can they do? That's how they feel. I'm in a bad mood. I'm feeling irritable or annoyed. And it's like, can't do anything with it. But of course, you know, if you've got a spiritual practice, you can work with that. Work with what you're experiencing in the present moment and transform that. Bring a more positive emotion into play. Because one of the most easy ways to deal with negativity is to acknowledge it. We're not trying to ignore it, not trying to say it's not there. You have to acknowledge it, it's there. But to bring up a positive state of mind, if we're feeling anger, annoyance, irritation, bring up some loving kindness for ourselves. Because we're experiencing this in our minds. And if we do this, of course, it transforms that anger, that irritation, it reduces, it goes down. And the mind becomes much, much more positive. So we can work with our minds. It's not as if, you know, we're just victims of whatever state of mind comes up. And of course, this is the Buddha's message. And of course, the classic teaching that Buddha gave on developing the mind is that we can use many different things to do this, but to bring up gladness. He talked about gladness, and then to bring up joy. And then he said, from joy, the body becomes tranquilized, becomes very peaceful. In meditation, sometimes it disappears, and then people get really frightened. Where's it gone? And then, after that, there's a happiness of being free of the body, of the aches, the pains, the heaviness of the body. And then the mind can come together, and this is called, Ajahn Brahm calls it stillness, steadiness, and one-pointedness of mind. And this is when the mind goes within itself and is very happy, blissful within itself, and is the basis for developing wisdom. Because a very steady, still, powerful, penetrative state of mind. Most of the time our minds are a bit scattered, all over the place, and so we can't see deeply into things, into the nature of life. And this is a very good way, this is the way the Buddha says, that naturally happens. And it's all from happiness. It's not from forcing the mind. So very important. So I was going to, as I mentioned, maybe it won't be very long, but to mention ethical behaviour and what sort of world we want to live in. And very much ethical behaviour is driven by that concern. What sort of world do we want to live in? Because the sort of world we want to live in, well, our behaviour has to match it, doesn't it, really? It has to be driven by that. And it's sometimes people think ethical behaviour, well, you know, it's a preliminary practice. This is what I've heard. I remember once at the monastery we had a very famous monk, Venerable Piyadasi, Sri Lankan monk. He had written many books and quite famous. And I remember asking him a question. I said, what's the most important thing in Buddhism? And I thought he would say enlightenment or insight into arising and passing away or some dukkha, maybe even dukkha, suffering. But he said ethical behaviour. And now as I have been a monk now almost 20 years now, I see how important ethical behaviour is in terms of a spiritual practice. It's absolutely foundational. If we don't have it, then the rest of the path is very, very difficult. Meditation is very difficult. We sit down to meditate. What comes to mind? What I've done, what I said, all those things will come to mind. And they undermine that, the stillness, the ability of the mind to come together, to be steady. So I often think of Venerable Piyadasi's comment that ethical behaviour is so important. And sometimes I say to people, I've been saying in Melbourne, you know, everybody wants to make a contribution to world peace. And often we think, don't we? I've thought of this. Oh, it's like, you know, big organisations making manifestos about peace and goodwill to all human beings. It's very nice. That's very good. But a very positive, a very practical way of contributing to world peace is ethical behaviour. Very, very, I mean, it's starting at, you say, grassroots, wouldn't you? It's each and every one of us can do that. And this is our contribution to world peace. And there's a very nice quotation in one of the Buddhist poems. There's a collection of poems by the enlightened monks and the enlightened nuns. And it's very nice that they didn't write these poems, actually they spoke them, these verses, some of them at different times. But there's one that I like very much, and this is by a monk called Silawa. And as the name suggests, Silawa is like ethical, but one who possesses ethical behaviour, virtue. And he said, I like this, virtue is the starting point and foundation, the mother at the head of all good qualities. Therefore, you should purify virtue. Virtue is a boundary and a restraint. This is interesting. And an enjoyment for the mind. Very nice. The place where all the Buddhas cross over. Therefore, you should purify virtue. So very, very... the number of other verses that go with this, just going on about virtue and how important it is and how wonderful it is and so on. It's something that most of us don't think of. How many of us would think of it, it was an enjoyment? But in actual fact, it is an enjoyment in the sense that if we keep virtue, then if we keep the precepts, for instance, then the mind can be happy, actually. They're not killing, we're not stealing, we're not indulging in sexual misconduct, we're not lying, and we're not taking drugs and alcohol that cloud our awareness. So naturally, if we're not killing, most people would feel quite happy that they're not doing that, that they're not stealing, they're not lying, these things. So this is why it can be an enjoyment for the mind. And also that the Buddhas cross over there. That's lovely, isn't it? I find that really, really, really... We often think the Buddhas cross over, you know, with the deep insights, with the path and fruits. These are the stages of enlightenment. But this monk was saying no. And I like, there's another quote that I like from the Buddha. It's lots of quotes at the moment. And this is very important, I think, for all of us, actually. And he said it to the monks. Monks, abandon the unwholesome. It is possible to abandon the unwholesome. If it were not possible to abandon the unwholesome, I would not say, monks, abandon the unwholesome. If this abandoning of the unwholesome led to harm and suffering, I would not tell you to abandon it. But because the abandoning of the unwholesome leads to welfare and happiness, I say, monks, abandon the unwholesome. And being the Buddha, he always puts the negative and then he would do the positive, about it is possible to develop the wholesome. A very incredible balance in the Buddha, actually. The mind is extraordinary when you read the Buddha's teaching. I hope I encourage you to do that. You see that, what extraordinary balance, covering all the possibilities. And oftentimes people will say, well, how do we know what is wholesome? How do we know what's positive? What's ethical? And the Buddha gave a lovely teaching to his son. Many of you probably heard the teaching. It's his advice to Rahula, his son. It's a very touching teaching. It's very nice to read. It's in the middle-length discourses because they say the Chinese version of the scriptures say that his son had told a lie, and this was the reason the Buddha gave this advice, actually. He told people that the Buddha wasn't in the monastery when he was in the monastery. And so the Buddha came to him and he gave him this teaching, which is the basis of ethical behavior. It was very, very nice teaching, actually. It shows the ability of the Buddha to really adapt to the situation and teach a very appropriate way. He started with his son had some water for him to wash his feet because he'd been walking. So he washed his feet and he had a little bit of water left, and he said, a person who tells a lie is like this little bit of water that's left in this bowl that's only little. And then he throws it away and he says, and just as I've thrown this water away, a person who tells a lie has thrown away, you know, the qualities of a monk. And then he turns it upside down and he says, just as I've turned this upside down, a person who tells a lie has turned upside down the holy life, the spiritual life. And then he turned it up the other way and he said to his son, just as this bowl is empty, so too is a person empty of the qualities of spiritual life who can tell a lie. It's just amazing sort of way to begin, you know. And then he gave the criteria to his son that he should reflect on before he spoke, before he acted, before he spoke, and before he thought. It's really classic because he says you should do this before, during, and after. Incredible, incredible. This is mindfulness, isn't it? Really attention to the present moment. And he said, his advice to his son was, we should reflect, does it harm myself? Does it harm myself? What I'm going to do, say, or think, does it harm myself? Or does it harm others? Or does it harm both? So, and he said, if it does harm, don't do it. Don't speak it, and don't think it, and let it be. So that's one quality. And this is an essential quality of ethical behavior, I think, realizing, is it harming anybody? It's very important. And then where is it coming from? Is it really coming from a negative motivation or a positive motivation? And in Buddhism, the negative motivation is this sense of greed, getting, wanting, also anger, ill will, and also delusion, often experienced as a strong sense of self, of self. And it can be also... So this is where it's coming from. If we notice that some action we're about to do, some speech we're about to engage in, if we've got the mindfulness... and some thinking is coming from these negative sources, then the Buddha advised his son, don't, don't. And then, being as comprehensive as the Buddha was, he said, look at the consequences of what you do and what you say and what you think. What are the consequences? Are they painful or are they pleasant? And this is a very good criteria for whether one should act or speak or think in that way. Because if we see that something is painful, is unpleasant, are we wanting to continue with that? Do we want to develop that? Of course, most people don't want to. We don't want to. We learn that, no, this leads to painful results. And of course, One of the most important criteria I find too, that I think is the essence of spiritual life, is really realizing that whatever one finds unacceptable, whatever one finds unpleasant, suffering, or difficult, other people will find that. So if I think, for instance, if I think, oh, well, I'll say something or do something, I'll often think, ah, would I like somebody to do that to me? Would I like somebody to say that to me? And when we use that criteria ourselves, that sorts things out pretty quickly, actually. Because if we don't like it, it's very likely that other people won't like it, and we shouldn't continue with it. And of course, one of the biggest things that helps, as it were, with this the basis of ethical behaviour is a sense of conscience. I think all human beings have a sense of conscience. There's some part of the human being that tells us, oh, this is not good. this is not, you know, something that's going to help myself or others. And in Buddhism we call this shame and fear, or hiriyotapa. And the Buddha said this was a guardian of the world. And there's a nice story, about time for a story, I think. and Ajahn Brahm tells this story too. It's an old story, very ancient story, of a teacher in India, and he had many students, and he wanted to test his students. So, and he was going to offer his daughter's hand in marriage to the student who could steal the most from the village nearby. But he said to the students, he said, one condition, nobody must see you stealing it, which I think is a pretty obvious condition. Otherwise, you'd be nabbed, wouldn't you? So he said that to the students. So every evening, the students would go into the village and steal this and that and accumulate all these goods, and were competing with each other to have the most, that they'd stolen the most. The village must have been villagers must have been very upset. And then it came to the day where they had the exam. They had to show what they had stolen, what they had accumulated in that time, that week. And they all had these piles of things that they'd stolen. And then there was one student that didn't have anything that he'd stolen. And so the teacher asked him, well, you know, why haven't you stolen anything? And he said, well, I remembered your instruction. He said that nobody must see us stealing. And there was always somebody there who was seeing me. He said, well, who was that? And he said, me. And of course, that's true for us. We're always, with whatever we're doing, we're there. Sometimes people think, don't they, if you can get away with it, nobody sees you doing something, whatever it be, that's okay. But of course, we're there. We're actually there. Me's there. So that's the sense of conscience that is very important for humanity. If we didn't have that sense of conscience, heaven knows what the world would be like. Many people think it's quite bad enough as it is, but in actual fact, it could be far, far worse. So, and the main source for developing the ethical behaviour in Buddhism, there's quite a few different levels, as you say, of precepts. These are the training rules. I like to emphasise in Buddhism, they are called training rules. The Buddha called them sikkhapada, and this is like a training rule. So they're not commandments. And the very nice thing is that usually when people take the precepts, say from a monk or a nun, they request it. And I always say to people, see, it shows this is voluntary. You undertake it for yourself, for your own well-being and happiness. You're not being forced to do it. Of course, in Buddhist countries, it's such a strong convention, people just take it without necessarily any intention of keeping it. Some people will, some people won't. And I say to them, taking the precepts is not great good karma, it's keeping them is the important thing. So this is what we need, what the Buddha advised anyway. So, and there's two levels to keeping the precepts. There's a level of the minimum level of restraint. You know, we talk about restraining oneself from doing various things. And there's also the level of development, the developing the opposite. So for instance, we have the first precept, I undertake the training rule, to refrain from killing living beings. This is deliberately killing living beings. Sometimes people say, oh, I walked on ants, I squatted a mosquito without thinking, you know. It's deliberately doing it. So this is the level of restraint, that we're refraining from doing that. Because we know, just as we like to live, all living beings, regardless of what, whether they're animals or insects, they'll want to live as well. So this is the level of restraint. But at the other level, the level of development, we can develop loving kindness. We can develop compassion for other beings. And this is, the Buddha encouraged this very much. And of course, if you have loving kindness and compassion, you won't be thinking of killing living beings. It overcomes that, maybe that tendency. And also it gives us a great happiness. There's happiness from loving kindness and compassion, which is a development of the mind. And of course, the next one is taking what's not given. I undertake the training rule to refrain from what's not given. This is stealing. And the wording is a little bit unusual for in the West, I think. But of course, the opposite of that is generosity, giving, not taking, giving to others, whether it be, as I say, material things or immaterial things. And so this is the development that we can do on our spiritual path. And there's a nice story. I like stories by Nasruddin, about Nasruddin. Nasruddin, have people heard of Nasruddin? I think it's very 70s or 80s, I think. Nasruddin, 1970s, 1980s. Nasruddin was a Sufi teacher, and as Jim Brahm would say, a bit of a scallywag too. And one day he was caught in the communal grain store, you know, in the village. He was pouring the neighbours, other neighbours, wheat into his jar of wheat, and he was caught, and they took him to court. And he said to the magistrate, he said, "Your Honour, I am a fool. I don't know their wheat from mine." And then the magistrate, being very clever, he said, "In that case, why didn't you pour your wheat into theirs?" Very good. And he said, "Ah, but I know my wheat from theirs." So he didn't know their wheat from his, but he knew his wheat from theirs. So this is the essence of stealing. But he was very, very clever with it. There's also a nice a joke that I read that was quite good on the same subject. And this joke was that a man wrote a letter to the tax office saying, "I have been unable to sleep knowing that I have cheated on my tax income, my income tax. I have understated my taxable income and I have enclosed a cheque for $150. And then he said, "If I still can't sleep, I will send you the rest." So this is another form. It's good, isn't it? It's quite good. So I don't know what happened. Anyway, and the third of the precepts is I undertake the training rule to refrain from sexual misconduct. And of course, this the opposite of that, of course, is developing contentment, reliability, dependability in our relationships. Fidelity, that's another word, isn't it? Fidelity. And this is a very important quality, a very important precept, because this is one that we see, doesn't it? It rocks people's lives, actually. It really destroys relationships and breaks up families and relationships in general. And so it's one that leads to violence and leads to many bad things in our lives, as does stealing too, and as does killing. And I think it's very useful here to quote what the Buddha had in mind. Because often, I don't know about you, but these days we hear a lot about in the press, don't we? Sexual misconduct is, I'd never heard that word much before except in Buddhist context. Now it's in the press all the time. But it's a very woolly term, I find. You know, I often think, what is this sexual misconduct? And then the Buddha spells it out. He says, having abandoned sexual misconduct, you abstain from sexual misconduct. You do not have sexual relations with those who are under age of consent, with those who are unable to give consent. And an example here is someone who is mentally disabled, who are not free to refuse consent. And the example here is students and a student to their teacher. And where such conduct would be breaking a law, even with one already engaged. So that's good, isn't it? That's very comprehensive. And I think very, very modern, really, for 2,000, over 2,500 years ago. I can't think of many other aspects to sexual misconduct that are not covered by that, actually. So very, very, very good. And then the fourth of the precepts that's very important is lying. I undertake the training rule to refrain from lying. And this, the opposite, of course, truthfulness. And this is a really important precept for developing the spiritual path, because the truth, if we're searching for truth, and that's the essence, isn't it, of spiritual life, searching for truth. If we're lying, that's the complete opposite of it, and especially if we're lying to ourselves, and then that's very much going against what we're aiming at. So if we want to find truth, we have to give up lying to ourselves, to others. And maybe I will tell another Nasruddin story. One time, Nasruddin's neighbour came to see him, and he said, "I'd like to borrow your donkey for the day." And Nasruddin said to his neighbour, "I've already lent the donkey." And then the neighbour heard the donkey bray. He said, "But I just heard your donkey." And then Nasruddin said to him, "Who do you believe, a donkey or your teacher?" I thought, very easy. I believe the donkey in that case. It's here and now. So that's another aspect too. Lying is, as I say, this is a very destructive one too, because if we can't trust each other, if we can't trust what others are saying, it destroys that basic trust which we need in relationships in particular, but in society in general. And of course, the last one is, I undertake the training rule to refrain from alcohol and drugs that cloud the mind, and instead to develop mindfulness and clarity, come from clearness, from an ability to be in the present. Because when we take alcohol and drugs, people can do anything. And of course, this is where a lot of the problems can come from. Domestic violence can come from. Many of the other precepts can be broken. Killing can happen, stealing can happen, all these things can happen. Lying, of course, when we take alcohol and drugs. So these precepts are actually the sort of, if we look at it really, as I mentioned before, what sort of world do we want to live in? Do we want to live in a world where we feel threatened? We feel that we could be killed. Do we want to live in a world where we feel our family or our friends could be killed? Of course we don't. Who wants to live in that sort of world? And the same with stealing. You know, who wants to live in a world where they have to be constantly looking after their property? I mean, you may say we do have to have that in mind. Of course we do in society, but not to the degree that we have to be really guarding it all the time. Of course we don't want to live in a society where stealing is rampant. And of course we don't want to live in a society where our relationships are broken up by others. And we don't want to live in a society generally where we can't trust anybody, what they're saying, can't believe them. I mean, so this is the sort of society we want to live in. We have to bring our own behaviour in line with what we want the society to be like. And not, of course, often we want the society to conform to what we'd like, but the way to do that, we do it first. And this is our contribution to society. And of course, so this is very much the world we want to make. This is very much the world we want to live in. And it's up to us. That's a nice thing with Buddhism. It's up to us. You know, nobody is going to be standing over us and saying, "Oh, no, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that." Only we will know that. Our conscience will tell us. So it's a very, as I say, very useful, a very important part of the path, essential, most important part of the spiritual path. And one of the things that I like about the precepts, it's a training for our minds, a training for our minds in developing this, I call it muscle of restraint, or the ability to refrain, to say no when we think of doing or saying something that we know will harm another or harm ourselves. And that ability is something that's is understated. You know, people don't think that's an ability, but actually that's a great strength, to be able to say no to something that, you know, we feel, well, we just want to do it, you know, automatically. And I like Bhante Gunaratana. I don't know if you heard of Bhante Gunaratana, famous Sri Lankan monk who lives in America, and he's written a book called Mindfulness in Plain English. It's a great, great book. And Bhanteji says, simply refuse to let your anger tell you what to say. And this is the essence of being able to restrain, to refrain. It gives us choice. We don't have to automatically, you know, give back as good as we get, as I say. You know, somebody says something nasty to us, we say something back to get even, or to do things that are to react negatively in our actions as well. So it's giving us choice. And this is a really, really important part of ethical behaviour. And probably the last thing I'll finish off with, a very important part, is when we have ethical behaviour, when we have a commitment to an ethical behaviour, it's like we're taking responsibility, not for our own actions, for sure, but also we're looking out for others as well by doing that. And we, instead of blaming others, we can look at what we're doing, what's our part of it, of the equation. And there's a very nice story, a simile that Ajahn Chah, famous meditation teacher, gave. It points this out very nicely, actually. It's like, he said, it's like there's a hole and a person puts their arm into the hole and they say, the hole is too deep. And Ajahn Chah says, they never think, my arm's too short. That's taking responsibility. So I'd like to finish there and encourage all of us, myself included, to develop, see the importance of ethical behaviour, see the importance of giving ethical behaviour and developing the mind, cultivating the mind. These are all very important. And what a contribution we can make to the world just by our own ethical behaviour. This is, we've got to start somewhere, don't we? And if, I often say to people, if everybody kept the five precepts, people think, that's basic, isn't it, five precepts? I'd say the world would be like heaven. Would be like heaven. It would be an amazing place. And they're just these five precepts. But if we start, who knows? I don't think we'll get the whole world doing it. That's not very unlikely. But I'd like to encourage everyone in that direction. So I'd like to finish there. And if there are any questions, I can see the iPad approaching. The iPad approacheth. So. There we are. So, first of all, any questions from the floor? And we can. Ah, yes. Over there? Oh, all right.
Bhante, you are living in Sri Lanka as a forest monk.
Yes.
You have met that famous monk, Venerable Nanadipa, who had been in the forest for 40 years, a Danish monk. I think many of us may not be aware of it. Can you give us a background?
Oh, right. Yes. Yes, there is a famous Danish monk who's been living in Sri Lanka, as you've said, Mahinda, for 40 years. His name's Rinwanyanadipa. He's a very inspiring monk. He's lived in the forest in very, very simple conditions. He lives in a three-sided hut, one wall missing, which is very interesting in the forest because it means you're open to the elements, open to the animals, the insects, the snakes that come and go. And I asked him one time, I said, why, Bhante, why are you, do you only have three walls? And his answer took me by surprise. He said, so I can see the forest. But he started a whole tradition of this. And of course, it's a very confronting sort of practice to live like that, because, as I say, you know, and I know monks that live in that area, it's a place in Sri Lanka called Lagala, and, you know, they have rats climbing on them in the middle of the night and snakes appearing and all sorts of creepy crawlies and whatnot. And so you're very much living as part of the forest, actually. You're not separated from a lot of these creatures. But interestingly enough, very, very, very seldom do, say, monks get bitten by snakes or get seriously injured by animals. It does happen, but very, very, not that often. And of course, we often say what protects people in the forest, the Buddha said this too, is our virtue, our ethical behavior. If we're harmless towards other beings, other animals, other creatures, they're often harmless towards us. And so this is a very, very important lesson for living in the forest. So he's a very inspiring monk. He knows the Buddha's teaching almost by heart. And it's always very, very marvelous time when we can discuss Dhamma, discuss the Buddha's teaching with him. And he knows it in great depth. And it's very, very wonderful. He's very interesting because he's supposed to have thrown his passport away. So he's living in Sri Lanka without a passport and with no intention to leave. And now he's 74 or 75, around there. So he's wonderfully inspiring. He's a very, very good example of living in a very austere fashion, like they used to in the time of the Buddha, and often compared, in my mind, with Venerable Mahakasapa, who was renowned for that, living very simply. That sort of austerity, it comes very naturally to some people. If it weren't natural, I wouldn't think it would be a good practice. You know, some monks will like, and some nuns too, like to live very simply, not, you know, live on the basics, live in very simple shelters, just go for the alms round to the village and so on. And he does all these things. So, and he's done it for 40 years. So, wonderful. Thank you, Mahinda, for that. And now, I just mentioned, let's see, this is from Florida. How can we give expecting nothing in return, not even good karma, or not expecting merits for a future life? Thank you. Well, how can we give? Well, if we can give wholeheartedly with a sense of joy and happiness, just at giving, that of course is the best way of giving. And the Buddha, he gave a number of reasons why people give, from the very lowest reasons to the very the highest or sublime, most sublime reasons. He even mentions one reason people can give is out of anger. It's interesting, isn't it? But his highest way of giving is that it adorns the mind. It lifts the mind. It beautifies the mind. So this is the very highest form of giving. No matter what one's motivation for giving, it will always have some good karma associated with it. And even expecting a merit, or, you know, like a merit, good karma coming back to us in future lives, that's not so bad. That's not so bad. It's not as pure, of course, as doing it wholeheartedly, just giving for giving's sake. And sometimes I meet people who really embody that. It's actually, that's a very good way, actually, for a person from Florida. If you see somebody who gives wholeheartedly, you can actually get an example, and that makes a big difference. And I've met people in Sri Lanka, elsewhere, who give so wholeheartedly. It's just wonderful. It just really inspires you, you know. And you can see how you can do it yourself. A lived example is really the best, actually, the best. So I would say that to the person in Florida who asked that question. And in another question from the UK, if we are content with where we are, happy to be here, yes, then we may never improve in a difficult situation. Right. Well, you could say that. You could say that. But if we're not happy to be wherever we are, we may not be in the present moment. We don't have to worry about not improving, because difficult situations will come up. That's the nature of life. And we have to deal with them in the best possible way. And of course, the best possible way is to be here and now. You may not be happy to be here with a difficult situation. That's pretty difficult. But certainly for most of our lives, many situations in our lives, we can develop that feeling of contentment, just happy to be here. The nature of our modern life is actually the opposite, isn't it? We're not happy to be here. We've got a big list of things we need and want before we get become happy, before we're content. We'll never be happy. We'll never be content that way. And of course, you know, that's a big part of advertising, big part of consumer society, is to keep us not content. Because if we're content, we don't need to go to the shops as much. We don't need to buy as much. But of course, the big message is that, you know, once we get this product, get that person, get this job, get this new laptop, get this new car, we'll be happy. But of course, it's never the case. We get some brief period where we feel like, oh, it's great, it's good. And then we're on to the next thing we need. So really, to develop contentment is the very best way to deal with things in the present moment, to deal with things in the best possible way. And also, if we're in the present moment, if we're content, this is what we're looking for in life, really, isn't it? It's what we're looking for. So if we can develop that more and more, and I agree, it will be difficult for difficult situations, it will be difficult, but if we can develop more of that when we come to the difficult situations, we can deal with it in a much better way. So, really, this is Indonesia now, another one. What is the best way to engage our family, especially our parents, to practice giving to others, Dana? Thank you. Well, I think good example. If you're Indonesia, if the person in Indonesia, you know, if they give a good example of giving, enjoying giving, your parents see that, your family sees that, then they will be encouraged to give. If they're Buddhists, then of course, you know, they can always reflect that the Buddha encouraged it. And actually, giving is a great way of developing us spiritually, because giving goes very much against that sense of self, what I need, what I want, what I like, what I don't like, all that stuff. And developing that sense of the others and what other people need. In actual fact, a life lived around the sense of I is miserable. It's a lot of suffering. But if we have a life giving to others, even giving to ourselves, then this is a much, much more positive and happy way to live. And so I would say to the person in Indonesia, you know, just if you are a good example of it, then they will be encouraged to do it as well. I mean, you can always mention that the Buddha encouraged it as part of the spiritual, our spiritual training. And that it brings happiness for us. So I think maybe that is a good way of this, all that comes to mind at the moment. So I think we can finish here now. It's now 9:01, so it's time to pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, if you wish. And those who'd like to come up after and ask questions, you're welcome to. Maybe our iPad. Very good. Thank you.
Sūpatipanno bhagavato sāvaka
So thank you for coming, and I hope you have got something from the teachings.